Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Debra.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to all of our listeners. I hope this is just a beautiful experience for everybody. Mm-hmm. It can never be, right? There's always ups and downs
in every year.
But it's always nice to have those wishes.
I think people are looking forward to the New Year, like just a change. I don't know, like a chance to turn things over and kind of start fresh.
Well, so. I certainly am happy to get rid of this last quarter because from my back going out and dealing with all that. And now these 3 weeks of bloody noses and I'm not allowed to friggin' blow my nose. And then I get a cold on top of it, waking up with snot-filled blood.
Oh.
Ugh, gross.
Oh, my God.
I have to tell you that just because you had to deal with the stomach flu with your
Not me, thank
kids.
God. But yes, my mom, both my kids. It's horrible. Everybody's just getting everything.
Was there snow in Lake Arrowhead?
No.
We didn't have any ability to ski in Santa Fe either.
Yeah, it's so strange.
I know. And here we're hearing the East Coast is just like
bitter.
Ungodly cold.
Yes, exactly.
Holy crap. So what did you end up doing?
So we went to Lake Arrowhead for a night. We went to Santa's Village.
It wasn't all that.
It wasn't. It was okay. My mom and I ended up ditching the park and going shopping. So that
was fun.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a good time. And then other than that, it's been really low key. I've been like cleaning like a mad woman. I've been like cleaning out my closet, the basement, just like getting things done and out. And that feels really productive and good.
Did you take the week off at least to?
You know what? I would have. But I went to my rehab job, but most of my clients were not around. So
it's pretty
slow.
Yeah. I have to say, as much as I love the people I work with, it's nice to sometimes just be off the grid.
Sure.
You know, just like away, checked out. Yeah.
So tell us about you. I mean,
I don't know. The last 2 or 3 weeks have been such a whirlwind. I can't even keep track because we had Tiffany and Michael came in, my daughter and her boyfriend, with their dog. They stayed with us for about 5 days. Then they drove to Santa Fe to meet us there. Mm-hmm. We got there. We all got there on the Saturday a week ago.
Okay.
And then they stayed for 6 days and then they drove off to Utah. So it was just like a whole
busy.
And I had other family from various ends of the world, including my niece from Hong Kong. So,
it's just
a little bit of time with everybody, but all kind of scattered and just too much activity. I really need a week off now just to try to sleep.
You do a lot.
I know.
You do a lot. You know what? Ever since my eye infection, I've been really slowing down and it's been helping me
a lot. And it's all better. I mean,
it's completely
gone.
Thank God. It's a little blurry. But I'll deal with that. Like, I'm so vain that I'd rather deal with the blurriness than the aesthetic. So, you know, I'll deal with it. But no, it really woke me up. It was like, okay, I'm doing a lot. I got to slow down and take it easy.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Because your kids rev you up a lot.
Oh, my God. Well, it's just like, I mean, I do a lot as is and then, you know, dealing with them. So.
Are they starting to chill out to varying degrees?
I want to say yes. And every time Casey, the garage attendant, the sweetest guy, he's always like, how are the boys? Every time I'm like, crazy. Like, and he laughs every time. I'm like, I know. I want to say everything's great and calm. No.
But the good news is you still have your hair.
It's gray. You know, I have to get it colored, please. And I'm probably going to die at a young age because of the craziness. But other than that.
So they're going to become menches later on.
I think so. I think they're getting
it all out now.
Yes, I've paid my dues.
But they're so sweet underneath all the monster veil.
They are. They really, thank God, they really are.
They really have adorable hearts. They're just so sweet.
Yeah.
I love them.
You're so cute.
But that's because I hardly ever get to see them.
I know, exactly. Come on over anytime.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we actually took the week off completely last week, and we didn't even air a rerun. So 2 weeks ago, we had on this really cool guy, Doug Hilton, who wrote the book EMDR and the Universal Healing Tao. I thought it was a really cool thing. I learned so many new things to do with EMDR.
I loved it, too, because I don't know so much about EMDR, but I really like the idea of including sort of this mindfulness aspect of it, and I like how he kind of takes it one step further.
Canadian. I love Canadians.
I know, me too. Every Canadian I think I've ever met has been the nicest person.
Yeah, there's a sense of friendliness and sweetness to that culture. I just love it, too.
Me too.
Okay. Well, without further ado, we have a great guest today as well. We have Mel Schwartz, LCSW, MPHIL, is a psychotherapist, marriage counselor, speaker, and author in private practice in Westport, Connecticut, and Manhattan for over 20 years. He is an emerging voice in the field of personal transformation and is one of the first practicing psychotherapists to integrate the principles of quantum physics into a psychotherapeutic approach. Mel earned his graduate degree from Columbia University and is the author of The Possibility Principle, How Quantum Physics Can Improve the Way You Think, Live, and Love, and The Art of Intimacy, The Pleasure of Passion. Mel has written over 100 articles read by nearly 2 million people. He had been a keynote speaker at Yale University and presented at TEDx Beacon Street on a talk called Transcending Anxiety. He also works with individuals globally through Skype. Welcome, Mel.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be with you both.
And you too. Okay, so I want to just dive right in. Tell us, Kelly may know more than this than I do, what is quantum physics? Just get that out there.
Nobody knows what quantum physics is.
Good, I don't feel so alone.
Yeah, exactly.
including myself. So I'm not a scientist. 20-some-odd years ago, I began to read about what quantum physics was telling us. Essentially, that reality is not the way we think it is. Simply, the principles of quantum physics are that nothing is predictable or deterministic, that reality is uncertain. Now, I looked at that, and I thought, anxiety, fear, all have to do primarily with my needing to know the future in advance, and I can't know it. But if I need to know it, it creates anxiety. Well, what would happen if I embraced uncertainty, which quantum physics tells us about? So I had a thought. Uncertainty equals possibility. If things are uncertain, why do we have to look at that as a negative? What happens if we learn to ride the wave of uncertainty? The other principle of quantum physics is that the universe, reality, is altogether inseparable. We think and see in separation. We see everything is separate from everything else, but that's a trick of mind. Reality is more like the Eastern mystical religions always told us about oneness, the spiritual traditions. But here's a hard science telling us it's true. So I look at inseparability, and I think the epidemic of depression we experience comes primarily from a feeling of disconnect. We're disconnected from one another, from nature. We were taught to think this way by 17th century thinker Newton. Newton said reality is like a giant machine, and we're just the separate cogs in that machine. We had no meaning and purpose, and we were disconnected. So I take these principles of inseparability and uncertainty, and I apply them to how we think, how we relate, and how we communicate, and use them all to our benefit. So it's not formulaic. It has nothing to do with math or science. I simplify the science to say we've been living from the wrong game plan, and that's why we're not thriving. So the book is about introducing a new game plan for living.
Mm. Okay, so you're saying basically that anxiety, depression, it's not biochemical, but it's rather basically what we're feeling.
Okay. Think of it this way. If you're walking at the beach in the sand, and you look behind you and you see your footprint in the sand, you wouldn't think that the sand produced your footprint. Your foot left its mark in the sand. Your thoughts leave their mark on your brain chemistry. It's not the brain that is producing your thoughts and feelings. We're not hardwired. That's Newton's machine terminology. Our thoughts impact our brain chemistry, which is good news because we are not subject to the brain chemistry. We can alter. People who meditate have an altogether different brain chemistry. If I can learn to replace my critical, negative, angry, fearful thoughts with self-sustaining, life-affirming thoughts, my brain chemistry changes.
That's also kind of the premise of cognitive behavioral therapy to some degree, yeah?
It is. It is, although what I'm doing is going way beyond the bounds of cognitive behavioral by introducing this new worldview. Mm-hmm. If we look at relationships, Oscar Wilde said uncertainty is the essence of romance. Probably true to some extent. So what happens? No sooner do we secure a relationship than everything starts to become predictable. And that's when passion dies. We finish each other's sentences. There's no wonder. There's no awe. There's this complete predictability in a relationship, which is romance-defying. Mm-hmm. So when we introduce uncertainty in relationships, not in a risky way, but in a healthy way, when we introduce uncertainty in regard to our thought, not being so sure that our beliefs and our thoughts are equal with being the truth. You see, that they're not the truth. They're just representing what we think we see. When we can look at it that way, we don't have to become our thought. In the moment, before you have your next thought, you exist in an absolute state of pure potential. But we keep having the same old thoughts. So what I refer to as thinking is the ability to see my thought and decide whether I want to attach to that thought or not. That way I'm present. I'm more than just my thoughts. And I teach the readers how to accomplish that. It's an entirely different experience of living that way.
I love it. So wait, back to the romance part. Of course, that's what always fascinates me.
Okay.
So it's almost like you're saying always keep them guessing, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe lots of surprises.
Well, but not guessing in terms of playing games.
No, I know. Right. But I'm thinking of something spontaneous and fun and different to introduce.
Look, let's look at our sex lives. If we know with great certainty when we're going to have sex, where it's going to happen, what it's going to look like, it's not all that passionate, is it? We get locked into habits. Mm-hmm. And when we live that way, we're not really alive.
Right.
Aliveness comes from spontaneity, mm-hmm. and being in the moment, and being able in the moment to step out of the predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of coming home and having the same old conversations at the end of the day, how about asking new questions? Questions we never ask, not simply how was your day, but different kinds of questions. What did you think about today? What did you wonder about? What are the questions you've never asked me that you might want to ask me? Because the majority of our relationship with our own self, we're not really conveying to other people. We're holding it separate, and that brings us back to this theme of Newton's separation, which keeps us disconnected.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
And, you know, the epidemic of anxiety, and I call it an epidemic, is due, in my opinion, to the fact that we are completely addicted to certainty in an uncertain world. I gave a TEDx talk mm-hmm. on that subject. And it's how we can literally not manage anxiety, but overcome it by learning to embrace uncertainty and releasing old thoughts that seek certainty.
Can you give us some examples of that? Because I think it sounds easier than it's actually done. I mean, I think if we can kind of break it down, it might help our listeners also.
Sure. I have many anecdotes in the book about people I've worked with and what they presented and how we overcame it. So here's an example. I was working with a woman who was mired in a miserable marriage. They had lost their path. They had no interest in common. He wasn't interested in marriage counseling. The good news is that they were financially well off and they didn't have children. So I asked her, why did she stay married? And she said, well, I don't know who I'd be if I were divorced. I don't know what it would be like. She had a fear of the uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She was choosing to stay mired in the known, although it was a miserable known, as opposed to move into the uncertain, which could be all full of wonder, great improvement and discovery, but she couldn't know what it would be like.
Mm-hmm.
So I created a visualization with her. I had her close her eyes and imagine that she's standing by the bank of a river. And I asked her to imagine the river metaphorically as the flow of life, her life. I asked her to picture moving into the river where the current picked up. I let a moment or two pass, and I asked her, where did she see herself? She said, well, Mel, I'm in the middle of the river, but I grabbed a hold of this large boulder. And I said, why? She said, well, the river bends up ahead to the right, and I need to know where it's going. I can't see around the bend. Let's call that her life as a divorced woman.
Mm-hmm.
I explained to her, no, you can't know where it's going, because that future hasn't happened yet. You have to let go of the boulder, but when you do, you're free to navigate once you get into the flow. You're not a victim of circumstances. You see, the victim of circumstances is the fear of engaging the flow of life, which requires embracing the uncertain. I've been fortunate enough to do that a number of times in my life, and I've had epiphanies. I've changed my life course because I wasn't afraid of the uncertain.
Mm. Wow. So whatever happened...
That's what brought me right here to be doing this work. I had been in business until I was nearly 40 years old, and I envisioned a big change in my life. I had young children, tremendous financial obligations. The customary belief at that point would be, you can't take a risk like that. But I knew I had to move in that direction, and I'm very thankful that I did.
Wait, so go back to the divorced woman. Did she end up getting divorced?
Yes, she did.
Oh, she did.
How's she doing?
and she shared with me that the password, I don't know if it was her email account or her phone, but her password was embrace uncertainty.
Beautiful. I love it. Wow. I love it. Well, so this is very helpful for me, too, because I said that I would be moving to Santa Fe in a couple of years, and I have both a tremendous excitement and freedom around that, and I also have tremendous fear around it. My whole life that I've established in Southern California with my practice and my home and my friends and all of that is just like, it's so hard to even consider that huge alteration. So maybe you could help me with that for just a moment.
Certainly. Well, what is your fear?
Well, I'm working on my fear of finances because I really think I'm going to be okay, because I do have control about how I budget and how I spend, you know, what I've saved and where that's going to go. Of course, the stock market could crash at any time, but we won't go there unless that happens. So it's more just that I might be bored, that I might regret that I'm not, you know, seeing as many clients. I'm sure I'll keep some of them because I can work with them remotely. But it's just going to be such a different life. So I guess it's the uncertainty. I mean, if you really go down to it, I am afraid of the uncertainty.
So what if you change your relationship with your fear? Fear is normal. What we want to do is change our relationship. And the change in relationship with the fear and the uncertainty would look like, I hope this all works out and it's great. But if it doesn't, there's no such thing as a mistake. I'm free to move from there to some other place where I'll prosper, whether it's geographically or financially. In other words, it's a step along the way. It may be great. You may live out your life in Santa Fe, or it may allow you a greater enlightenment and insight about yet another place to move to. They're just steps along the pathway. So we look at these decisions as though they're final outcomes. And that's what roots us in fear, and the fear of making a mistake. Mm-hmm. People who have hard times making decisions are avoiding uncertainty.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But as you know, if you don't make decisions, and you've made a decision to go. But instead of worrying about, is it a mistake, how it will work out, it's an experience you're going to have. You'll see how it works out. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't as gratifying as you anticipate it should be, it will inform you toward another decision which you're not aware of yet. That's being in the flow.
And that's also why I'm keeping my Thousand Oaks house.
Oh, you are going to keep that? Oh, that's perfect.
I'll keep it and rent it out so that if I really don't like it, I get to come home.
Perfect.
That's great. And by the way, you know, being the reference you made to finances and your financial well-being, how about envisioning new streams of income for yourself? So it's not just about budgeting money and the stock market. How about being able to envision prospering in a new way financially?
That's another part of my excitement, actually, because I think it will be fun to try and do different things, even if it's just volunteering. I mean, not even so much about the finances, but just to do something very different. Yeah.
Yeah.
More radio, more writing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great new adventure that awaits you.
So, nice. Okay, so, I mean, I actually am thinking of somebody who I know very well who is terrified to make any decisions and would actually stay, kind of like what you were talking about with the divorced woman, would stay in a really bad situation just because of that fear of the change. And is it that, so obviously they're not embracing uncertainty, but is it the fear that it's going to be worse, or just that they don't want to take the steps? Like, what do you think those people are? Why are they so paralyzed?
I think at the core, it's the fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
You see, what we want to do is create freedom from the known. We get addicted to the known, and it makes our lives very, very confined. Now, how did this come into being? Let's go back to Newton. Newton told us that if we had enough information, today we call it data, mm-hmm. we could reasonably predict the future. This was known as determinism. And it works very well and is necessary in a lot of areas in our lives. But when we become addicted to determinism on all levels, it deprives us of the capacity to be human mm-hmm. and to thrive in our lives. It's almost as though we're living life like it's a chess match. We're sitting back and deliberating and calculating, what's my next move? Is it right? Is it wrong? Will it be a mistake? That's not living life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we need to actually reconsider how we're going after living, because living that way isn't really living. And that's why one out of three people in their lifetimes will have an anxiety disorder, and maybe one out of two will experience depression. In other words, this epidemic of emotional and psychological malaise mm-hmm. is due to the fact that we're living from an insane game plan for life. And when we introduce a new game plan, a new rule book, so to speak, we can actually thrive in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I experienced this on a personal level. That's how I came to this. Going back to that decision to become a therapist, well, that decision provoked a divorce in my life. My former wife wanted no part of that life transition. So fast-forwarding a year or two later, I'm starting a practice. I have two young sons who are living with me most of the time. And on one weekend, they're with their mom. I get up to take a bike ride. It's a beautiful spring day. And I have an anxiety attack in the middle of that ride. I felt disconcerted. I was missing my son. There was an uncertainty about what would my future look like. I went home and absent-mindedly pulled a book off the bookshelf called The Turning Point, which was a book about this paradigm shift coming from quantum physics. And within reading a few pages, I noticed I was no longer anxious. And I was thoroughly immersed in this. Well, it's 20-some-odd years later, and it's just never stopped for me.
Wow.
That was a turning point for me. And it came from looking at things differently. So I apply these principles to our patterns of thought, the way we relate, and how we communicate as well, because it's most important for communicating differently. Mm. So what does that look like? When we communicate, we speak objectively to each other. And so in close relationships, that is the death knell of a relationship. When we start a sentence by saying, you are, or I am, objective statements, it immediately puts the other person on the defensive. Mm. When we learn to speak subjectively to each other and express, I feel, I think, we're just speaking representatively, the other person can stay engaged. But it's a new method of communicating based upon this worldview where everything's connected with everything else.
I like that.
Me too.
As I was hearing you speak a few minutes ago, though, I was kind of thinking I'm a little bit of a creature of habit, and I actually like routines. So there is still room for, you know, sort of managing our day-to-day things in a way that feels organized and grounding, or are you saying to not even have that?
No, I have no issue with routines, particularly if they're good routines. It's more a matter of what goes on in our minds, really. I wrote an article years ago called What If? Now, people who think of what if, that can go in the negative direction or a positive direction. What if with disastrous outcomes, or what if with a sense of wonder? What if with a sense of wonder is, these are really provocative, generative thoughts to have. You know, when I thought of closing my business, I thought, what if? What if I went to graduate school, pursued something I feel passionate about? What if I could write books and give lectures and do workshops. Boy, that would seem gratifying. Well, why can't I? And that led me down that road. Mm. So, you see, it's just a thought. If my thought was, well, that's impractical, I can't do that, how am I going to support my children, it'll take so many years, the reality is constructed by the thought I have.
Yeah, this makes complete sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I love, there was a question in your press kit that both Dr. Deborah and I loved, and it says, you are saying, who am I, is the wrong question to ask ourselves. What's mm-hmm. the correct question?
Okay. Who am I suggests that there's a fixed, specific answer to the question that limits who I am. Mm. I propose, and this is an article I wrote many years ago, Who Am I? I propose what we should be asking ourselves is, how would I like to experience my life? Mm. See, who am I is reductive. It's reducing me to a few sentences. How would I like to experience my life is forward. It's progressive. It's expansive. Mm-hmm. They are two completely different questions. We have to pay close attention to questions. So how would I like to experience my life shifts me from a state of being, who am I, that's a limited being, mm-hmm. to a state or a process of becoming. How would I like to experience my life is about becoming, mm-hmm. evolving, growing, expanding. Now, if I want to engage in the process of becoming, like that metaphorical visualization for the woman, she's going into the flow of life. She's in the process of becoming. But see, she was stuck with, who would I be if I were divorced? Mm-hmm. That's a who am I question. Mm-hmm. It's who am I or who would I be? Instead of, how do I want to experience my life?
So I love this and I totally agree. However, what if you almost can't change your situation? For example, I'm making this up, but you have to sort of take care of your elderly parent and mm-hmm. you kind of can't get out of it, but you're having these negative thoughts. And like, what do you do in that situation where you really can't kind of take action around it?
Well, I think that the only thing reasonably that we should want to be able to control or master is our thinking. So if you're constrained and limited because you have finances or taking care of other people, so you're not free to move, but your thoughts, your thinking can still be free. So your thoughts are the filter through which you experience your life. So if I can't move on because I can't afford to hire help for an elderly parent, it's my responsibility, I'm still free to engage thinking that can help me prosper even in those circumstances. So maybe I always wanted to write articles or become an author or mm-hmm. become an artist or things that wouldn't require my moving on physically.
Sure.
Maybe I can learn to meditate or practice yoga at home or mm-hmm. develop different kinds of relationships. The constraints in our lives are most primarily due to the rigid pattern of old thoughts and beliefs that constrain us. And that doesn't require anybody else's permission for us to change.
I love that. I think as I'm listening to you, I'm trying to think of some of the tools that I use in my own world when I feel like I have to like that, Kelly, mm-hmm. you know, where it's like,
yeah,
oh, I
sure.
have to do this. I look at it and I go, I probably don't have to do that. I still am choosing to do that because have to's, there's just not that many have to, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, mm-hmm. in order to mm-hmm. live, I have to breathe.
Sure.
But my body does that for me. But it does really help me sometimes to go, even with my clients, take a look at at least the small element of choice that's in there, too, because that always feels more freeing to me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a very good distinction. We make up these narratives of a have to. Most of those things we don't have to. It's important for us to transition into saying, I choose to, because then we're responsible, mm-hmm. and therefore I can choose not to. Mm-hmm. Choice is important. And when we choose, then we are alive in the moment. I can choose to feel angry and notice that I'm feeling angry and then communicate effectively to someone about how I'm feeling. I can choose not to become angry, but to appropriately communicate how I'm feeling. That's a choice. So therefore, I'm not reactive. I'm responsive. It's choosing.
You have a phrase in your book I really like. It says, silence is leaden, not golden. I like that.
Yes. We often think of the controlling person as the loud-mouthed, aggressive bully. I've seen in my work with couples that silence is controlling. Mm. It's so controlling because, one, people tend to play out entire scenarios in the silence of their own mind. We indict someone, we convict them, they are who we've decided they are, and they never even know we're doing it.
Right.
Mm. That's controlling. Two, through silence, there can be no resolution. And silence, I have seen as punitive and controlling, because when one party is angry with the other person and chooses to be silent, that's punishing.
Mm,
it's punitive.
Yes.
So I'm not talking about being self-reflective and meditative. I'm talking about using silence in a manipulative way, and that's very damaging.
Very damaging. That's a great point. Yeah. Do you have any passive-aggressive people in your life, Kelly?
It's so funny. I know you have a ton, right? Don't you? Like, I have a few. But I see a lot of my clients who have that too.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that there are some people on my extended version of life that they never really say what's on their mind, but you know there's something negative going on in there, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think
But sometimes that may be due to their own fear.
Sure.
You know, we may be thinking of as passive aggressive, which just may be symptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
They can have fear about how will we respond or react to what they say.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so they don't say it, but they nevertheless act out because of it.
My favorite is in couples when somebody gets mad at the other one for speaking up about something, and the other one says, "But I never told you I was upset about blah blah." It's like, why the fuck didn't you say you were upset about blah blah? What benefit did you give to us by never telling me that you were bothered by that?
Well, I noticed it's so much cultural too.
Sure.
I mean, it's really interesting. Like, some cultures, they're sort of, you know, brought up to speak their mind and be direct. In other cultures, it's like, no, we sweep it under the rug and you don't talk about it. And it's really interesting.
If it's not nice, don't say it at all.
Exactly. Yeah. And just, you know, just deal with it.
I have to tell you my funny story about Tiffany. That's my daughter. When she was about 3 years old, we were in line at the supermarket and getting some food. And I was holding her and she looks at me and she goes, "Mommy, that's the biggest nose I've ever seen," to the gentleman who was standing in front of us. And of course, people around me seemed mortified that I wouldn't reprimand her. And I'm like, well, and the guy was so nice. He turns around and he goes, "Hello, young lady, what's your name?" And asked her name. He says, "Would you like to touch it? It is awfully large, isn't it?" He was just so humble and sweet about it.
That's a beautiful story. I remember as a young boy, one evening, my parents said, it was a Saturday evening, they always had friends dropping over, and I remember them saying one evening, they hoped that they didn't have any company that night. They just wanted a nice, chill night at home.
Mm-hmm.
Half an hour later, the doorbell rings, and they go and answer it, and it was company. And I piped up, "Mommy, Daddy, look, there's the company you didn't want."
That is so funny. What was everybody's reaction?
I can't recall, but it was a great sense of embarrassment,
of course.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Kids just, there's no filter. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Remember they had that show, was it Art Linkletter or something? Kids can say the darnest things.
I love it. I write down what my boys say.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
You should.
I mean, because it's just so funny.
It is.
So funny.
Yeah, but so you look at that imaginative sense of wonder in children, and look what we do.
Yeah,
we in a way, there's a kind of a child abuse that goes on beneath the surface.
Mm.
We are in such a drive as a culture to turn these dear, precious young children into highly productive, academically achieving robots that we deprive them of play, wonder, the free time of childhood. Everything is programmed, and it has grave consequences. The loss of wonder in childhood concerns me greatly. Mm-hmm. I remember my younger son coming home, I think it was maybe a fifth grade report card, and it was kind of disappointing. And I gave him the typical speech. And he looked at me and he said, "Dad, I'm just in fifth grade. My grades don't count yet. Uh-huh. When I get to high school and they count, I'll get serious. In the meantime, I'm just a kid. Oh. Would you let me just be a kid?"
Oh.
And there was such a sense of wisdom to that question.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it in.
Right.
Because forget about fifth grade. Right from the start, parents are going crazy at early ages about mm-hmm. preschool and schools and what colleges will they get in 15 years. Now, how about academic achievement's an important piece of life? Learning to live well is more important.
Mm-hmm.
So often with parents, I may say to them, "You're worried about what college your kid will get into, but your child is not prospering right now socially. They don't have friends. They have anxiety disorder. Why is the focus on what college?
Mm-hmm.
How about what do I need to do to help my child thrive in their life?"
Right.
And then get into the best college they can.
Sure.
Sure. That makes sense.
It's a loss of priority.
Mm-hmm. If you've just tuned in, we are talking with Mel Schwartz. He's the author of The Possibility Principle. This is so amazing. Like, I feel like these are the late night college conversations that I would have, you know, after some drug-induced substances.
I have a completely off-the-wall question, though. Having been in this field for such a long time, what does MPHIL stand for after your name?
So that's a master in philosophy, which has nothing to do with philosophy. It's a British degree. It's a British degree, and it's an advanced research degree. Many years ago, I was working on a PhD in England toward my new approach to therapy, and was well along and achieved the master's in philosophy, which meant they gave me a green light, clear sailing, you can finish this dissertation. And I didn't, because I decided to go out there and write this book instead.
I
thought it would be more helpful to publish the book than some arcane dissertation hanging in a library somewhere, which no one would read.
Mm. That's great. Amazing. I love that story. That's perfect.
Wow. And I love that. So I'm Jewish, and I'm assuming you are, and I love that. But you can't get out of it. My maiden name was Rothenberg, so I couldn't get out of that one. Now it's Miller, but Mel Schwartz, I mean,
there's no
avoiding that one.
No.
I love it.
How do you help couples stop arguing and really listen to one another?
Many ways. In the book, I have a chapter on communication. I developed something called the 5% rule. It goes like this. When you're in an argument, the way our thoughts operate is we're going to hear something that's wrong. We're going to repudiate it. We're going to prove that they're wrong and I'm right. Well, number one, if I have to be right and you have to be wrong, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggest that my clients do something counterintuitive, which is usually there's a small percentage of what the other person is saying that you might agree with. But usually we don't go there. So what I propose is that you suspend temporarily argument. Doesn't mean you're caving in. But the 95% you don't agree with, put it off on the shelf for a moment or two. Find a small percentage, I call it 5, of what you're hearing that you agree with. Now turn and validate the other person with that 5%. Find something you can agree with and validate it. Now, that shifts the entire energy of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
They feel heard and validated and understood. Then, presumably, they're going to be in a position to hear something you want to share. It shifts us into dialogue and into collaboration. The either-or thinking, the right versus wrong argument, is antithetical to prospering in a relationship. Ultimately, the question is, would you rather be right or would you rather be understood?
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather be right or would you rather be heard?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then we all say, I'd rather be understood and heard, but we go back to that argumentation about right versus wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeply embedded in our need for gratification to be right.
Yes.
So if I want to be validated, the pathway is for me to find something I can validate in what you've said, then my words will no longer be falling on deaf ears. That makes sense. But it's kind of like foaming the runway. If there's something you want to share that you think is going to be met defensively or with reaction, spend a few sentences preparing the other person. You might say to them, you know, I'm struggling with something I want to talk to you about, but I'm feeling like you're just going to get angry or shoot it out of the ballpark, so I don't know what to do. Now, at that point, you're enrolling them. They may say to you, no, I won't. Tell me what it is. And actually, their reactivity will be greatly mitigated and lessened then. It just is a few sentences. There's a way to get into mindful, effective communication. The problem is, no one ever taught us. Mm-hmm. If these things were taught to us in school, we'd be living in a different world.
Wow.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I know. We don't teach enough about anything
that's
to deal with life. And
no, we don't teach emotional relationship. We don't teach effective communication or intimacy. I've just begun rolling out a series of live online workshops.
Oh, nice.
Where I'm teaching all of these things because it's not too late for us.
Uh-huh.
You know, these are all things that we can easily learn.
It's so true.
I don't even know that that's ever been part of a curriculum anywhere.
What, communication?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny.
No, it hasn't.
Relational, I think there's just general communication.
Yeah.
We used to have what was called seminar day in my children's high school, and I'd be invited in on occasion to give a talk. And I proposed that in the curriculum in school, there should be relationship and communication classes. These are the foundations that are arguably far more important than math and science.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's what you need to prosper in life. It's why we fail in our relationships and in our marriages, because nobody ever taught us. I can't begin to tell you how many people I work with on a premarital level who are having no problems, but they're wise enough to know what's likely going to happen to them down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So they come to me to get the training that they didn't get anywhere else in life. That's wise.
It's so interesting because my older son, he's 8, and I'm teaching him now. I'm like, what is the most effective form of communication? And because I'm trying to say to him, it's face to face. Because with these kids today, they really think it's text or email, you know. And then I'm like, no, it's sitting in front of the person and actually seeing their expression and things like that. So I'm trying to instill that in my kids as young as I can.
Yeah, at least if you're on the phone, go to FaceTime.
Well, that's what he said, too. My older son said that. He says, well, Mom, FaceTime and you know, face-to-face are tied. That's what he said. I said, yeah. It was cute. Yeah.
Right.
Very interesting.
Now, some preschools, though, I think that the more advanced ones, they are more attuned to helping children learn how to play nicely. Not nicely, like as if they're supposed to hide who they are, but play, you know, in a way that's respectful and speak about things in, you know, their feelings and such. Did you notice that with your kids?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Sure. Yes. Much more.
Much more now than it used to be. I think we have a greater sensitivity to that because I don't think that was even present in Tiffany's preschool at all.
Right.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, are we going the opposite spectrum? And this might be for another show, but are we validating our kids so much that they're never wrong and they're going to grow up, you know, to be narcissistic and entitled and,
Good question.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a fine line. And certainly there is that aspect of the culture. And there's still the aspect where kids are being denigrated and humiliated as well. It's not either or. I think both are happening.
Right.
I think, you know, the excess of validation may occur in more affluent communities.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to validate what a child is feeling, because feelings aren't right or wrong.
Right.
They are. Uh-huh. So we want to validate a feeling. Validate doesn't mean I agree. Validate means I want to understand what you're feeling.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Right.
So validating a feeling is fine, but you can then separate that from actions. So you're feeling really angry. I want to understand that. I have compassion for why you're feeling angry. Let's talk about it. But that doesn't allow you to act out aggressively to your siblings or your friends or anything else. So we need to make more distinctions.
Yeah, true.
But again, that's really around emotional intelligence.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And, you know, arguably the parents didn't get any coursework in emotional intelligence. So we have to start somewhere. I do a workshop called Raising Resilient Children, mm-hmm. in which I say we have to throw away the parenting rule book because it doesn't work very well.
Right. Yes, 100%. Mm-hmm. Wow. So we're almost out of time. And so I wanted to make sure that if you wanted to say any last thoughts or get in anything that you didn't have time to share.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last thoughts right now are probably more inspirational. The most important relationship you will ever have isn't with your parents, your children, your spouse, your partner. The relationship that will impact you far more than any other relationship is with your thoughts. They're your constant companion. They can be your worst critic or your best ally. And you can learn to develop an effective, powerful relationship with your thoughts and then be able to live the life you choose. So that's not like a new age pie in the sky message I'm putting out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it's hard. It's that it requires your belief that it can happen and your intention to do it. And then you really can live the life more or less that you want to live and choose to live.
Mm. So nice. Very well said.
And I'm assuming your book is on Amazon and all the major sites.
My book is everywhere. You just type in the possibility principle. You will come to the book in the different places you can buy it. And if you want to learn about my online workshops, my website is melschwartz.com.
Amazing.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was fascinating.
Thank you both. You have a great day.
Yes. Too. Okay. Bye-bye. Awesome.
Wow.
So next week we have Dr. Sherry Steins, who's going to talk to us about narcissism, our favorite subject.
It'll be really interesting. And I want to hear her thoughts, too, about, you know, children today. And are they going to be more narcissistic? It'd be really cool.
Absolutely. Let's see. What do you think? I think yes.
I do. Yeah. Sadly.
I think more. What am I saying? More. Yeah. There will be more.
More. I agree.
Yeah.
I think so,
yeah.
too. I do.
Because I think the pendulum of entitlement has swung so far over.
Oh, my God. Well, and if you just think about just the fact that they get everything so much quicker. So I think that in itself, it's like, remember I told you we ordered something online and my son's like, okay, where is it? You know, my younger one. And I'm like, no, it takes like 2 days to ship. Like, that's not even quick enough, you know?
No, it's
so
one
it's
click
like,
of the button and it's supposed to appear,
right.
Almost encouraging magic.
Yes. And not learning
magical
patience.
Thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that'll be cool.
Oh.
So yes. Awesome. Well, follow us on all of our good Instagrams at Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly, and that's DRDEBRA and Therapist Kelly, and Twitter is at Doc Therapist One. Our Facebook is Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, and our website is docandtherapist.com.
Absolutely. Okay, everybody Stay healthy or become healthy if you aren't already.
Exactly.
All right, love you. Happy
Bye-bye.
New Year.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.